I was gonna do something along like bonds, bail bonds. I feel like that's terrible. I can't make the wording work.
What about getting bailed out of having to do the zinger? You know, that's what you're trying to.
That's worse, Peter. That's worse. All right, let's do it. I'll work my way there.
Michael.
Peter.
What do you know about bail reform?
All I know is that the example of New York City teaches us that the real way to solve crime is to have 10,000 cops standing around playing Candy Crush on their phones.
So this episode is a Peter talks about what he wants to talk about episode. Although we are a media criticism podcast, and This is one of the most consistent types of media failure in this country, which is media coverage of crime.
Crime stuff.
And specifically the way that the media digests information about crime that comes from the police.
It is wild that like surveys have shown for decades that like 75% of Americans are totally misinformed about like the nature of crime, like whether it's rising or falling, where it's happening, the types of crime. And like people in the media are just like, well, that's weird. And just keep doing the same thing.
I think you're giving them too much credit by imagining that they think that that's weird. I don't think they think about it at all. So there are a lot of ways in which this problem manifests in media coverage. I want to focus on a bit of a case study, an ongoing drama, bail reform in New York.
How wokeness has driven New York City to new depths of criminality.
I do want to note up top, this will not be a comprehensive discussion of bail reform. This is a bird's eye view.
And this is a bonus episode, so you've read two Wikipedia entries. You're ready to talk about it.
I read two Fox News articles on the internet.
And one Media Matters report. It's going to be a both sides episode. And
right. And then I read a Twitter thread that went absolutely nuts. No, as usual, I started off being like, I'm going to read almost nothing on this. And then by the end of it, I was so deep in the literature that now I feel like I am the foremost bail reform expert in New York State.
Considering how many people write about this topic without fucking knowing anything about it, it's actually that's plausible that you are.
No, I don't want to be unfair to a couple of my sources here who are located in New York. Folks at the Brennan Center, who I guess know more about this than me.
Oh, you actually talk to people. Okay.
I know. It's
Peter.
The worst when you end up having to do work for this podcast.
I know.
But it happens almost every time, I got to say.
I hate learning stuff.
Just to put us in the right mindset here, I'm sending you a YouTube link.
I think I know what this is going to be.
No.
I knew it was going to be this guy. Okay.
Mayor Adams and the NYPD officials took to the podium today to say our current criminal justice system simply isn't working.
Yeah, recidivism rates are up and courtrooms are now becoming revolving doors for repeat offenders. Morgan McKay joining us live now from One Police Plaza with the latest reforms that local leaders are pushing for. Morgan.
Lori and Teresa, Mayor Eric Adams once again attacking New York's bail laws, placing the blame for the rise in crime entirely on the back of these reforms that were first passed in 2019.
Our criminal justice system is insane.
Long wind up, but I'll allow it.
Oh, God, it's so good. I'm sorry.
It's still funny to me that I watch local news like once every 5 years, but they still have the thing where they're like, let's cut to Sandy in the field. And then it still takes like 5 seconds for them to be like, thanks, Susan.
First of all, they threw to Sandy in the field, who then just threw to a clip. What's Sandy there for? So first of all, obviously, I wanted to include that clip just because it's extremely funny to hear Eric Adams talk.
Yeah. Unfortunately, everything he says is kind of funny.
It's hilarious. Another thing to note about that clip, those anchors just like recited what NYPD said, right? They were like, courtrooms are becoming revolving doors. No context, no questioning the narrative at all. Just reprinting the NYPD characterization of the situation.
Peter, now my right-hand bar is suggesting a Today Show clip called Growing Number of Women Report Being Punched on NYC Streets.
This was huge on New York TikTok.
I'm so nervous you're becoming a TikTok guy.
The way that people were talking about it on TikTok, you would have thought that everyone's just out there bobbing and weaving, just like dodging punches. No, what actually happened, it was just like one dude who was walking around like near NYU and punched a few gals.
You shouldn't do that.
You shouldn't do it.
I mean, it's bad to punch people, but also it's like this, I don't know why this needs to be like a national news story.
So yeah, and anyway, that's what your YouTube algorithm is going to be like for the rest of your life.
100%.
So, before we get into this, we should sort of introduce the idea of bail, because I think this can all sound a little bit confusing to lay people, especially if you haven't encountered this system.
If you're not a fancy lawyer.
To simplify a little bit, if you are accused of a crime, you will appear in front of a judge and they will set a trial date. And then they will decide what should happen to you while you await trial. One option is to just release you. Mm-hmm. Another is to impose bail. Mm-hmm. What that means is that you are sent to jail until you put up the required amount of money. Mm-hmm. The money will be returned to you after you show up to your required court appearances. Mm-hmm. If you no-show, you forfeit the money. If you don't post bail, you can be kept in jail until your trial. The primary idea is to compel people to actually show up to court. It's also about public safety to some degree.
Which is why sometimes bail is revoked. They're like, you're such a danger to society that no matter how much money, you can't get bail.
That's the third option. Judges can remand you to jail without bail, meaning you have to stay in jail until your trial. Yeah, mostly reserved for the most serious crimes, right? Mm-hmm. Now, there are a bunch of problems with this system. The most obvious is that it significantly disadvantages poor people who are often forced to remain in jail for lengthy periods of time pre-trial.
Right.
This is, of course, despite the fact that they haven't been convicted of anything yet, right? They just can't afford to pay bail at this point. And that's another very fundamental problem with this system. It essentially assumes the guilt of the person who's being charged.
Right, because it can be months before your trial.
It can be years.
So you're just sitting in, like, essentially prison because you can't afford, like, $500.
Right. This has also been shown to coerce guilty pleas.
Right.
You're much more likely to plead guilty if you are in jail. It destabilizes people's lives because while they're in jail, they will generally lose their jobs. They will obviously be away from their families. There are obviously also racial and income disparities. Studies have shown that Black people get detained pre-trial more often with generally higher bail, even controlling for the offense. Mm. So the primary argument for imposing bail is that these people are a high risk to their communities, even if they haven't been proven guilty yet. Mm-hmm. I don't want to dismiss this argument offhand. There are situations where it's certainly true. There's obviously some level of truth to it. Mm-hmm. But I do feel like it's fundamentally disingenuous, because if you really thought that all of these people were too dangerous to let out, why are you allowing them to get out if they hand over $1,000 or whatever, right? Right.
It's just a check on whether the person's rich, essentially.
Right. So there have long been efforts by criminal justice reform advocates to either eliminate or severely restrict bail, at least for certain low-level offenses, meaning that, like, if you're arrested for nonviolent crimes, for example, the law would require that judges release you before your trial. Maybe the biggest driver of reform in New York specifically was the story of Kalief Browder, who's the 17-year-old who was accused of stealing a backpack and then held in pretrial detention on Rikers Island for 3 years.
Yeah.
He spent 800 days of that in solitary confinement, and the charges were ultimately dismissed because the DA just had no evidence. And then he took his own life a couple years later.
Yeah, it's horrible.
It was symbolic of all the problems with cash bail, both in theory and in practice, right? An innocent kid sits in jail for 3 years, effectively being tortured in solitary confinement for most of it, all because he was falsely accused of some low-level bullshit crime.
And also, frankly, even if he had stolen the backpack, that sentence would have been insane for that crime.
So in 2019, New York State passed a law that eliminated the use of cash bail for misdemeanors and low-level felonies. The idea being that, like, obviously for minor crimes, the costs of bail outweigh the benefits.
But then does that mean, so if I get arrested for, like, shoplifting or whatever, I, like, go in, I give my fingerprints, I get the mugshot, and then I just go home. And they say, okay, your trial's in 3 months, and I show up to the trial. And if I don't show up to the trial, then, like, they put out a warrant for my arrest and they come arrest me for, like, skipping my trial.
You would appear in front of a judge. They would give you, get arraigned. They'd give you dates. Then you'd show up back. You'd go home and then show up back in court whenever they told you to. Yeah.
There's still consequences for missing your trial date.
You can also do, they can also monitor you in various ways. They can have check-ins that, you know, certain people will get ankle monitors, right, while they're out pre-trial. There are ways to be practical in terms of how you're tracking releasing people pre-trial right. if you really feel like that's necessary without remanding them to jail.
Right. While allowing them to keep their jobs, take care of their kids, etc.
Exactly. So very shortly after this law is passed, there is backlash in the media. Mm. And it comes in the form of anecdotes. In late 2019, there's a steady trickle of news stories about a handful of cases where someone was released after an arrest and then reoffends.
Okay.
There's a particularly bad one in December 2019. A woman assaulted several Orthodox Jewish women on the street in Brooklyn while shouting, "Fuck you, Jews."
Oh, my God.
She was released, attacked another woman the very next day or a couple days later. This gets picked up by the New York Post.
Of course.
There are a couple of things to note here. First, the charge was third-degree misdemeanor assault. Even before bail reform, people charged with third-degree misdemeanor assault were released without bail about 90% of the time.
Okay.
Second, Tiffany Harris, the defendant, had a history of psychiatric issues and a recent arrest for assaulting people on the street, both of which the DA initially missed.
Oh.
This type of story is very emblematic of the discourse.
Yeah.
The details and nuances get lost, and instead of doing a serious analysis of like what worked here and what didn't,
right.
the media starts to view the entire law through the lens of a bunch of ugly-looking anecdotes, right?
It is typical that like at the most basic level, if you're going to blame a law for an outcome, what the media should be doing is like asking whether, oh, is there a meaningful link between this law and the outcome? And it sounds like in this case, there isn't.
I think part of this is the result of media folks not really understanding exactly what bail reform does.
Yeah.
You know, the story of the anti-Semitic attacks, that's an example of sort of sloppy reporting.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little bit maybe dishonest by omission, you could say. But a lot of the contemporary reporting was just outright misinformation. There was a report done a few years ago by Laura Bennett and Jamil Hamilton for Forward.us that cataloged a few of these. So in a normal situation, a judge has discretion. A judge can release you, impose bail, or send you to jail, no bail, right?
Mm.
Bail reform basically says in certain situations, they have to release you.
Mm-hmm.
This is baffling to the media for some reason.
Mm.
Newsday published a piece that cited bail reform as the reason that a man charged with a fatal DWI was released without bail. In reality, he could have been held with bail under the law. The judge just chose not to.
Oh.
So this is a mistake that you will see the media make all the time.
Mm.
A judge chooses not to impose bail, and bail reform gets blamed, even though it's unrelated.
Right.
There was a woman who committed a fatal stabbing, who it turned out had been released before trial on an earlier charge of second-degree assault. ABC 7, the local ABC affiliate, reported that this was due to bail reform, but in fact, it was not. It was another case of the judge deciding to just release the accused, even though they could have imposed bail.
It's so weird because, like, couldn't these people just pay money and get out anyway if it was a bail
yes.
reform issue? Like
yes.
the anti-Semitic lady, it's like without this law, she could have paid $500 and then gotten free and then committed another assault.
Yes.
So like what's really the difference?
What they're really doing is like a word cloud.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's like Democrats, bail reform, criminals on the
right.
streets, murder.
Right. It's like refrigerator magnets. It's just like a bunch of concepts.
And then there's another case. The New York Daily News ran a story headlined, "Set Free to Rape, Suspect Busted in Train Station Sex Assault Was Freed Through State's New Bail Reform Laws."
Mm.
The story is about a 20-year-old man who had been held in Rikers for several months on a robbery charge, but was released due to the bail reform charges, and then, according to the story, was charged with attempted rape on the subway. Problem with this one is that he wasn't charged with attempted rape,
mm.
nor was he arrested for it. He was charged with stealing $120 from a laundromat.
Oh, what?
Police thought that he might be the assailant in an attempted rape case.
No way.
But they did not have the evidence. As far as I can tell, they never brought rape charges. This is just some cop who was like, "We think he might have done this other thing, too." But they fucking perp walked him in front of the media and his pictures were in the Post. It's crazy.
No way. Okay.
I also want to note that it's true in this case that he had been released due to bail reform,
mm-hmm.
but he had been sitting in Rikers on a robbery charge for nearly a year.
Mm.
At any point during that year, they could have gotten their case together and attempted yeah. to try him on that charge.
Right.
Instead, they stood around holding their dicks for a year and then mm-hmm. they complained to the press when the guy's released.
My mom was on a jury duty last year for a case like this where a guy got his bike stolen And there was like super janky security camera footage, like middle of the night, black and white, terrible security camera footage. And the trial, like the defendant in the trial was basically some random homeless guy who a cop was like, oh, I recognize him on the video. And like, that was it. It was like this super shitty video. There's no other evidence against him.
I have to like hold in my thoughts on cops in these episodes.
Dude, it's rough out there, man. I know.
The Albany Times Union ran a story about a couple of teenagers who were convicted on weapons charges and then released pending sentencing. They claimed that this was due to bail reform. This has nothing to do with bail reform. It has nothing to do with bail at all. They were tried and convicted, and then they were set free prior to sentencing, which is just another part of the process, okay, right? So you get convicted, and then if the charge is not super serious, you will sometimes be released prior to your sentencing. CBS2 printed a straight-up lie from the Nassau County Police Commissioner claiming that some of the specifics of the reform laws, which required that prosecutors hand over important evidence to the defense, claiming that those requirements got a state witness killed.
Jesus Christ.
Totally made up. Not the reason why the witness was killed. The commissioner had to walk it back, but the story was never retracted. It's like still up.
This is actually very similar to the right-wing psychos. Like whenever there's like a plane crash, they're just like, it's DEI. Or like a boat crashes into a bridge. And they're just like, it must have been DEI. And it's like, sorry, is there any actual theory here? You're just barking about something you're already mad about.
That one's true. I consider barges to be girls. That's some of the more express misinformation that's sort of trickling through the media about bail reform in early 2020. There are also some like subtly dishonest ways that you see these stories framed. I'm going to send you a New York Times piece. You can just read the headline here.
It says, after anti-Semitic incidents, new bail law in New York comes under attack.
Given the headline, you would think that the anti-Semitic incidents in question were connected to the bail reform in some way.
Right.
Now, I'm going to send you just a quick line from that piece. I'll put that in the chat, too.
It says, the new law also corresponded with a swell of anxiety and fear stemming from several high-profile anti-Semitic attacks, including the stabbing of five Hasidic Jews at a rabbi's home in Monsey, New York. Okay, so it corresponds with a swell of anxiety and fear.
Right. You can see that this language is a little bit weird, right?
Right.
The law corresponds.
Right.
Not even with the attacks, with a swell of anxiety and fear stemming from the attacks. The bail reform situation applies to misdemeanors and nonviolent felonies. It wouldn't apply to a mass stabbing situation, nor was it responsible for releasing the person who did that stabbing. This is, again, the sort of like word cloud method of reporting this stuff. This is a classic Peterism, so I'm sorry, but like this does remind me of stock market news.
I thought you were going to say in the micro, in the macro.
So no one knows why exactly the stock market goes up and down, right? Mm-hmm. You can tie it to certain events, but you can't really say it's causal.
Right.
So the way that reporters tend to do it is that they'll do what I call the amid method of reporting. Amid concerns about X.
Right. Amid Taylor Swift's Eras tour.
And I'm sure some academic has already studied this and has a better term for it, but I don't know what that is. So I'm calling it the amid method of reporting. Here's another quote from that article. Jermaine D. Williams, the New York City public advocate who led a rally on Tuesday outside Manhattan Supreme Court in support of the bail reform law, said, quote, anti-Semitism has been on the rise for years. Bail reform has been in effect for 6 days. And here's how the New York Times closes this out. Nonetheless, the anti-Semitic attacks have helped ratchet up political pressure on Democrats.
This is another like Peterism of like, but still.
He just absolutely wrecks this fucking argument. And then they're like, nonetheless, this is pretty bad for Democrats, don't you think?
I love it when they tuck it in like the second to last paragraph where they're like, to be sure, this is fake. Anyway, at the part of the article that nobody reads to.
All of these stories, every story that I've mentioned so far, is within weeks of the law being implemented.
Yeah.
So it's not just that they're anecdotal. It's that there's genuinely no data yet at all.
Right.
Which means it's probably relatively irresponsible to be reporting on this, period.
Mm.
And if you're going to report on it, it's not enough to just write about random criminal defendants who commit crimes while they're released. You need to write about people who the law is helping if you want to talk about it, right? There needs to be something that looks like balance.
Right.
And so I think the lesson of these articles is that, like, A, a lot of these media folks just don't know how this shit works.
Right.
B, a lot of this is just sort of a form of guilt by association, right? These are like propaganda campaigns that are designed to generate headlines about crime and then the term bail reform in some order.
Right.
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 Just so people start associating them.
Right.
And this works. The result of this media blitz is a complete change in the public perception of bail reform.
Yeah.
In April 2019, a poll of New York voters found that 55% supported bail reform. By early January 2020, when the law had been in effect for a few days, support was at 37%.
Oh, wow.
So an 18% drop. And that's without any fucking data at all.
Right. And just from juxtaposing, like, anecdote, law.
Right.
Because you could do this with, like, rates of immigration have risen. And there's also been, like, a 10-point increase in murders.
Good thing no one's using anecdotes about migrant crime to drive opposition to immigration, despite a lack of data.
It is an election year.
So this, of course, creates public support for bail reform. This is early 2020, right? As you probably know, there was a big nationwide crime spike in 2020. Mm-hmm. No one knows exactly why. It's obviously probably traceable to the pandemic in some way or another.
I like that you said obviously probably. It's definitely likely.
This is the sort of nuance that you can only get on If Books Could Kill.
You're juxtaposing the pandemic with the crime rise, Peter. Wow.
How dare you claim that I said that the crime spike was traced to the pandemic when I said it was probably obviously traced to the pandemic. So you had this massive media blitz. And then in March, as the pandemic begins, you have a spike in certain types of crime. Mm. Murders and rapes were down at that point, but there had been like a 10% increase in assaults and larceny in New York. So that's not nothing. It's also not a like enormous spike or anything. It could be a bit of a weird anomalous blip, especially since the pandemic was getting underway. Now, to be like clear, there's absolutely no evidence at this point linking those increases to bail reform. And there were, in fact, similar spikes across the country.
Right.
So it's pretty clearly not bail reform, or at least not mostly bail reform, right?
Again, super basic questions. Did crime rise more in places that had bail reform or not?
But, of course, that doesn't really matter. Because coupled with all of the bad press, there is a ton of pressure on the New York State Legislature to act. So in April 2020, just 3 months after the law is in effect, lawmakers reform it. They make it so that pretrial detention is an option again for some nonviolent felonies, and they add a provision that basically says if you have multiple pending charges for causing harm to a, quote, identifiable person or property, you can be held on bail, which is sort of vague. You don't need to understand all the technicalities. The basic rule is now that if you commit one offense, are released, and then commit another offense before your trial, you're now eligible for bail. Bail reform does not apply.
Okay.
So I want to point out, just as an aside, this is a wild time to be creating avenues for more people to be crammed together in jail.
Yeah.
As this reform is happening, there's a COVID outbreak on Rikers Island.
Right. So we're sacrificing the health of people accused of nonviolent crimes to safeguard the nation's backpacks.
A couple of big developments over the ensuing years. First, there is, in fact, a huge spike in serious crimes during the pandemic. Murders jumped nearly 40% year over year in New York. That's relatively consistent with the rest of the country. There was a 30% increase nationwide, so a little higher in New York. Mm-hmm. And that drives the next major change in the reform discourse, which is the election of Eric Adams.
Yes, finally.
To the position of mayor in New York City. Adams is a former cop. He hates bail reform. He gets into office in early 2022 and immediately starts pressing the issue. Mm. Probably the most notable thing about Eric Adams, both with respect to this issue and in general, is that he is one of the most prolific liars and dummies in American history.
One of our great political weirdos.
One of the funniest things about him is that he will lie for like sport almost. Like one of the first times this popped up was that he was like frequently talking about being vegan.
Yeah, I was just going to say this. He like lied about his diet.
And then people would be like, well, you've been seen eating cheese and fish in public. And he was just like, yeah, well, I'm not perfect. And it's like, well, then why did you bring this up? I don't understand. Dude.
No one. Yeah, exactly. No one was like harping him about like, what's your dietary restriction? It's like you were the one that told us about this.
I can't. There are so many fucking goofy ass Eric Adams things. Mm. I'm going to send you a clip. If you can go to the 19th second here.
I want it to be the backpack one so bad. Copy link. think.
Let me know when you're there.
You know you can share links with a timestamp, right?
I'm aware of that in theory. I've never actually done that. Yeah, I don't know.
Wait, God damn it. Hang on. I got to get it to 19 and then pause it.
All this could have been avoided if I just learned the basics.
You just learned the basics. Okay, count us down.
3, 2, 1, play.
When you look at the totality of the year, if you had to describe it, and it's tough to do, in one word, what would that word be, and tell me why?
New York. This is a place where every day you wake up, you could experience everything from a plane crashing into our trade center to a person who's celebrating a new business that's open.
Okay, boss.
What?
All right.
Oh my God. And then YouTube suggests under the video, it says September 11th attacks.
Oh God. I don't want to get sidetracked. This has nothing to do with our episode. It's just the funniest Eric Adams clip in history.
I love it. He's just like free associating.
Dude.
You can open a pizza place. You can have 9/11.
He got into some political hot water for this, just the 9/11 comment, which made us all lose sight of the fact that the guy was like, what's one word that sums up this year for New York? And he's just like, New York.
That's also the funniest shit. Even if it was one word,
right.
What's one word that sums up Seattle? Seattle. It's not a good answer.
You can experience anything from a plane crashing into our trade center to a new business opening.
To a new business. A thing you can see in every city in America, by the way. So at least 9/11 is unique to New York.
That's the one thing we'll always have.
Dude, I feel like we need to make a pact that if anyone ever asks us to describe our podcast in one word, we have to say if books could kill. It'd be an inside joke that like 12 people would get.
Oh my God.
Very important to me.
So Adams essentially joins the anti-bail reform PR effort. Mm. He starts to say that he's like never seen crime this bad in New York City. A ridiculous statement for someone who was a cop in the 1980s.
Yeah, yeah.
In April 2022, we get another round of changes to the bail reform law, carving out some gun offenses and also making shoplifting bail eligible.
Really?
Yeah, that's the sort of the output of the shoplifting panics during the pandemic.
It's like the lowest crime imaginable. It's like one step above jaywalking.
As a confessed shoplifter, you think that, sure.
I thought you would have forgotten about that by now.
Forget that I do a podcast with a criminal? Never. Adams and his allies, still not satisfied. In August 2022, he and the NYPD put together a report and then a corresponding press conference where they highlight the so-called worst of the worst repeat offenders in New York City. Basically, the report discussed several serial repeat offenders, which they were claiming were like emblematic of a broken system.
Yeah.
In the report, they kept the offenders anonymous, but someone in the NYPD leaked at least one name to the New York Post.
God, of course.
All right. Well, you're going to get mad at me again. Let me see if I can do the timestamp.
Oh my God, this looks like with my parents.
We'll see. What? All right. I'm doing the share.
Wait, hang on. All my settings are at 2x. Hang on.
All right, hold on.
Dude, for book club, I was listening to a book at 2.5 yesterday because I had to finish it before book club. It was deranged.
That's wild. Okay.
It was like the end of like every pharmaceutical ad. Right? It was like, make out your love, you're sleeping.
Well, that's the old way. That's the old way they used to do it. Now it's just a lady gently telling you, like, you'll be bleeding out your asshole. Yeah. Like at some point, like 15 years ago, they focus grouped the speedy disclaimer right. thing. And they're like, actually, it'd be better if a nice lady very slowly but nicely told you that it causes cancer. That actually works better.
With the intonation of like a meditation video.
Right.
And breathe.
Don't take this medicine if you're white.
All right. Okay, 145, cut us down.
3, 2, 1, play.
They say the difference... Definition of insanity is to do the same thing repeatedly, but expect different results. Our criminal justice system is insane. It is dangerous, it is harmful, and it's destroying the fabric of our city. Time and time again, our police officers make an arrest, and then the person who is arrested for assault, felonious assaults, robberies, and gun possessions, they're finding themselves back on the street within days, if not hours, after arrest. And they go on to commit more crimes within weeks, if not days. We want to be clear here. This is not merely a reform of laws, action, and call. Every piece of the criminal justice system must use the tools that are available to them.
All right, we can stop. I get so mesmerized by him.
I know. I was like, let's keep going. This is
there's just something about how obviously dumb as shit he is when he speaks.
He's not really like saying anything. Like, we must use the tools that are available to us.
What he said was, time and time again, our police officers make an arrest, and then the person who is arrested for assault, felonious assaults, robberies, and gun possessions, they're finding themselves back on the street within days, if not hours, after the arrest. Felony assaults are not something impacted by bail reform. Adams and the NYPD very consistently make claims like this to sort of like put in your mind the idea that there are people being accused of violent felonies who are just being released back on the street due to bail reform.
Right.
So in May 2023, we get another round of reforms. This time, they get rid of the requirement that judges use the least restrictive pretrial conditions necessary, which was part of the first round, and they replaced it with one that basically allows the judge to do whatever they think is reasonable. So what remains of the original bail reform law now is primarily that there's a certain set of nonviolent misdemeanors for which you can't be held pretrial. Which is not minuscule. I think that's really the core of the law, so I don't want to be defeatist about this. My interest in this is mostly that these media narratives were able to drive three consecutive rounds of amendments to this law.
Right.
It's especially interesting because they really just don't have good evidence that bail reform increases crime in general.
Right.
All of the real solid evidence points the other way. There are a ton of studies about this. There's a study by Paul Heaton at Penn Law who looked at data from Harris County, Texas, the county containing Houston, where there were similar reforms, and found that there was no resulting spike in crime. And in fact, people who are not detained pretrial are less likely to commit crime in the future.
Right. If you're unemployed, you're more likely to be like strapped for cash, or maybe you resort to crime to do something about it. Like, yeah, it kind of makes sense that something this destabilizing would make you more likely to commit crimes.
So for New York specifically, the Data Collaborative for Justice has been doing ongoing studies of the impact of bail reform. They've found no impact on overall recidivism. There are some caveats, with the main one being that bail reform appears to result in higher rearrest rates for a small group of serial offenders. So if you have no recent prior arrests or you're arrested for a misdemeanor, bail reform makes you less likely to commit another crime in the future. But for people who do have recent prior arrests, being released without bail makes them slightly more likely to reoffend. This is basically in line with what a lot of reformers have said, which is that bail for first-time offenders and low-level offenders risks disrupting their lives and making them more likely to reoffend, right? But the other side of that is that if someone is already exhibiting a pattern of consistently committing crimes, releasing them without bail doesn't seem to change that behavior.
The problem, though, is that little improvements like this don't produce anecdotes in the same way. Like, this guy got arrested for shoplifting, and because of the bail reform, he was able to, like, keep his job.
Not a hot story.
Yeah, whereas in a big system that applies to millions of people, someone is going to get out on bail and, like, commit a fucking murder.
That's a huge PR advantage for opponents of bail reform, because they can just latch on to these anecdotes and make the conversation about those specific situations and those specific people, right?
Right.
And
right.
I also want to point out, and I'll keep harping on this, like, recidivism isn't the only metric here, right?
Right.
When you
right.
say, oh, it might not impact recidivism that much, that doesn't mean it's a wash. That means it's a huge benefit, because a ton of people who would have otherwise been at Rikers Island, a fucking hellhole, are free to, you know, to be with their families, keep their jobs, et cetera, without a negative impact on crime rates. That is a huge win.
Something I think about all the time is when I was living in London, there was this anecdote about a guy who was out of prison on a furlough, like a day-long visit thing, and bought a lottery ticket, and then he won. And people, like, lost their minds, and, like, Tony Blair, like, talked about it. It was, like, a whole fucking thing. And it's, like, this has never happened before. And there's no reason to think that this would happen again for, like, 60 years.
Right. One of the least likely things in history.
Yeah.
That's great.
It's just like, you don't actually have to do anything about this. But this was like days of media coverage of this. And it was like an actual scandal. But the entire idea of a media scandal or a political scandal is totally constructed, right? The media could have just ignored this. Who gives a shit, right?
This brings us to sort of part two of the episode, which is how exactly this happens. Like, what's happening on the media side that is causing this? I do think the fact that these anecdotes of crime are sort of necessarily sensational is a big factor here in what drives these media narratives. But I do think there's something else happening here in the background, which is that in the last decade, since the beginning of the Black Lives Matter movement, police have been investing heavily in PR. Alec Karakatsanis, a lawyer and activist, has written a bunch about this. But in 2020, in the midst of the George Floyd protests, the LA Times did some reporting and discovered that LAPD had 25 full-time public relations staff.
25?
25.
Dude!
And LA County police had 42.
Dude.
That is 67 full-time state employees doing PR for cops in LA alone.
Dude, that's bigger than like the Seattle Times. That's like a huge fucking newsroom. What the fuck do they even have to talk about for that long? Jesus Christ.
In 2014, Chicago PD had 6 full-time PR staffers. Then a Chicago police officer murdered Laquan McDonald.
God.
And the next year, there were 25.
Jesus Christ.
Now, there are 50.
Is this why all the podcasts are about murders now? There's PR teams, like, pitching the latest murder?
That's the big expose. The My Favorite Murder Gals are cops.
We're finally coming for them. It was inevitable.
I couldn't track down the staff numbers for NYPD. Maybe someone can help me, but they're floating around somewhere. But their communications budget has shot up about 70% over the last decade, now hovering around $180 million.
Jesus Christ. For PR?
That's comms broadly. So PR is a subset.
Dude.
Think about how effectively they were able to push back the Black Lives Matter sort of rejuvenation of 2020, right?
Right. You lefties say that all this police spending isn't effective. And yet, when they need to get propaganda out, they can do it.
There are full-ass educated adults who think that we defunded the police. That's how effective the police PR machine is.
Police cannot solve crimes. They can, however, tell people that they're really good at their jobs.
I think you're asking a fundamental question. What are these people doing?
Yeah.
In broad strokes, they do strategic messaging, and they coordinate with media outlets.
Yeah.
San Francisco PD has a PR unit that does strategic early intervention with the families of people killed by cops.
No way.
When judges make decisions that the police don't think are tough enough on crime, like setting low or no bail, police PR teams will leak the story to the media along with the judge's name. This is something that reporting has found judges are very aware of. The fact that if they do release someone without bail, they are risking being in the headlines if the person commits another crime, especially, right? With their name and picture being circulated on social media by fucking lunatics, right?
And also they have to get reelected too. So that's also like a bad structural incentive.
In cases where there are elections,
yeah.
So on the other hand, if a person is held in jail for months on end before eventually being found not guilty or having the charges dismissed, police won't say anything because they don't give a shit,
right?
So there's this very perverse incentive structure in place for judges, and police are very flagrantly trying to exert influence over what's supposed to be an independent decision maker.
It's wild how like the most radicalizing thing against American policing is just like basic facts about its like operations. It's like everything I learn about the cops, I'm just like, holy shit, this is like a ticking time bomb. In like every American city, we basically have these like quasi-military forces made up of like mostly right-wingers who are just very like openly engaged in a propaganda effort against any progressive reform.
Right. These PR teams do feel-good stories that make police look good.
Oh, like that shit where the quote-unquote viral videos where they pull somebody over and like give them a turkey on Thanksgiving.
I'm going to send you 5 news stories.
Okay.
Just read me these headlines one after another.
Oh my fucking God. Okay. Real quacky problem. That's not even really a pun. Montgomery County officers save 8 ducklings trapped in storm drain. Oh my God. SF officers quack the case, save baby ducklings. That one's better. 7 baby ducks rescued in Alameda County Sheriff's first drone rescue. I'm sensing a theme, Peter. I don't know. I haven't quite put it together yet. New York State troopers save baby ducks after car hits their mother. I'll bet it was the cop that hit their mother.
No, because then they would have used a passive voice. After mother hit by
cop. After mother hit, yeah. And then the last one is Salt Lake City police rescue mother duck, 8 ducklings at police station. Holy shit, Peter. This is dark. These are all different cities.
These were all compiled last January by John Hamasaki, who's a lawyer and activist. He was just messing around on Twitter. All these stories dropped within a few months in 2022. You can find
countless
stories about cops rescuing ducklings if you Google it.
Dude.
What's likely happening is that cops at like national conferences and things like that.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking too, yeah.
They put together cohesive strategies. They talk about what works and what doesn't, etc. And that's why you see this stuff pop up all over the country.
Yeah.
So that's sort of, that's just a quick hitter on the PR apparatus, but it doesn't really explain why the media plays along, right?
Yeah.
A major thing going on here is that police PR operations make a journalist's job extremely easy.
Yeah, yeah.
If you're a local news anchor or a newspaper reporter, you essentially have quotas to hit, right? You have to produce X amount of news content in a given week.
Right.
So here's what Alex says. Another producer explained to me that police public relations employees do not just call reporters and tell them about a story. When police give stories to the media, they often contain video, audio, screenshots of documents, or other easy visuals. Police and prosecutors also routinely have teams ready with often ludicrously inaccurate charts and graphics showing supposedly relevant statistics. Mm. Police and DA offices, which have their own publicly funded PR teams, also pay spokespeople to be briefed and prepared for soundbite interviews or otherwise make available employees to ensure that there is a person who is prepared to be on camera for a news interview.
Right.
Police are feeding journalists ready to print content, right?
Right.
Full news segments being handed to them.
Right.
That is why they have a full-time staff that looks like it's the fucking Seattle Times or whatever, because it sort of is.
Right. And it's also, I guess, partly because of this like years-long effort, crime is not seen as something that journalists have to get like the other side of.
Right. Right.
Any issue about like trans rights or something, it's like, oh, let's hear from the Westboro Baptist Church. But if it's crime, it's just like you can just report that a crime happened. I think it's seen as like objective news. It's not seen as political, even though it's like deeply political.
This is why I started this episode by saying like this is basically a bird's eye view, because there's also something going on here about like the psychology behind how Americans process crime, which you couldn't possibly study enough to understand.
Yeah.
But for whatever reason, there is no level of crime so low that people will not believe a story about crime being high.
Dude, there was a case in Seattle where like our data journalist did like neighborhood by neighborhood breakdowns of crime. And obviously the white affluent neighborhoods had the lowest crime rates. And people in those neighborhoods like barraged him with emails for like days. Like he had to write a whole follow-up column being like, no, guys, all the data we have indicates that crime is low in your neighborhood. But people just like wouldn't accept it. They were just completely allergic to this, basically because I think they were just on like fucking Nextdoor all the time.
Right.
Basically hearing about every single petty crime that takes place in their rich little enclave. And they think that that's the tip of an iceberg, but it's literally just every crime that you find out about.
Half of me is always like, you know, I don't want to be judgmental. People who are frightened living in New York City, et cetera. And the other half of me is like, we are a nation of cowards. Are you fucking kidding me? You're still fucking scared? Like,
yeah.
Steven Pinker has explained to you how good things are, and you have the balls to still be scared. Like, I have friends living in like the most polite little suburbs who act like a home invasion is like impending at any time.
Right.
There is something in the American brain that is very susceptible to like the fear of being the victim of crime. And I don't know exactly what it is, but it's there.
I feel like it's even like deeper. I feel like it's like a human thing that, you know, if you look at urban legends or like moral panics and folklore from hundreds of years ago, a lot of them are like crime based, right? They were like, the Jews are going to kidnap your firstborn child, right? A lot of it is about sort of existing societal outgroups. A lot of urban legends are around like, if you flash your high beams, this person will kill you, right? Or these like, these gangs are celebrating this holiday with these weird rituals, or Satanists are everywhere. They're just something like kind of universal of it. Like there's this deep, dark evil that there's no evidence of, but it's just below the surface. It could happen to anyone. This is like the center of so many of these like crime myths, and they're very consistent throughout time. That and adulterated food is like the other main theme of urban legends.
So let's shift back to New York. if you look at this massive PR apparatus and then you look back at some of the misleading stories I talked about earlier, they start to make a lot more sense, right?
Yeah.
What's happening is that the police are very intentionally pushing specific stories wrapped in a bow to various media outlets who are then reporting them without asking any real questions, right? Should go without saying that, like, poor people thrown into jail don't have a PR apparatus like this,
yeah,
right? But I also want to point out that, like, neither do victims of less sensational types of crime, right? Everyone knows that, like, wage theft dwarfs larceny, yeah, in this country, right?
Yeah, tax evasion.
There's also, like, pollution and shit like, yeah, that, right? And the victims of these types of crimes don't have 67 full-time PR staffers, yeah, in LA alone.
Yeah.
So what this creates is a world where there is a hyper-focus on very specific types of crime in very specific types of communities. And the media has a ton of incentives to just sort of play along because it's very frictionless for them.
Right.
So what's happening in New York is that despite the fact that we've now had three rounds of changes to the bail reform law, police are still very actively pushing against it. Bail reform popped up again in February because of a case that made national headlines where several migrants in Times Square were alleged to have attacked police officers.
Yeah, I remember that.
They were charged and then released without bail, with one exception. One guy was given bail. A great picture came out of the migrant being released and giving the middle finger to the cameras.
Nice.
I think it was dual middle fingers to the cameras, mm-hmm, which, of course, a great outrage if you're a Fox News viewer.
Oh, that? They did a whole fear-mongering thing about that?
Oh, this was a massive news cycle on the right.
What?
Yeah. It was more part of the migrant crime moral, right, panic than the bail reform moral panic,
okay,
right? But this all gets jumbled together, of course.
That shows how much it's just like aesthetics. It's like, look right at how uncouth they are.
This led to some choice news coverage, of course. The Albany CBS affiliate ran a headline that said, migrants accused of attacking NY officers fuels debate over bail reform.
Ooh, fuels debate. Okay, another one.
But again, these guys were bail eligible. The judge just decided not to issue bail, at least for most of them.
Mm.
So this has nothing to do with New York's bail reform laws. These terms, yeah, just continue to get jumbled,
right,
in the media coverage. And the impression that people are left with is that, like, progressive bail policies aren't working and they are responsible for shit like this, right?
It's like all this progressive change has gone a little too far, even if there wasn't all that much progressive change.
And, right,
like, even if it has nothing to do with the actual crimes in question.
So then a few weeks back, an NYPD officer was killed in the line of duty, basically while trying to apprehend a couple of guys who were illegally parked and acting shady. The man who actually shot the cop was not out on pretrial release and, in fact, had not been arrested since bail reform was enacted. So the murder itself, nothing to do with bail reform,
yeah,
okay? But the guy who did not shoot the cop, was arrested on a gun charge a year prior and was out on $75,000 bail.
Mm-hmm.
Again, nothing to do with bail reform. The man,
right,
was given $75,000 bail, not a small number, and posted it.
Right.
And yet the media conversation about the shooting has continuously invoked bail reform. The,
right,
New York Post wrote, quote, progressive policies such as bail reform have been blamed for Diller's tragic death.
That's the chicken shit thing, is like it has been blamed correctly or incorrectly.
Amid debates about bail,
yeah,
reform, like, cop gets shot. That's what,
yeah,
is happening here. Like, very slickly eliding the fact that bail reform is completely fucking irrelevant to the situation.
Yeah.
The Hill's coverage said, quote, Diller was shot Monday in Queens at close range, prompting more calls for Hochul, Governor Hochul, and the state to address the issue of bail reform. What the fuck are you talking about?
Well, yeah, why would you...
CBS's,
yeah,
New York affiliate did another very common thing, which is just quoting law enforcement officials or politicians without any pushback on what they're saying. So they quoted Anthony D'Esposito, a U.S. House rep and an ex-cop, quote, I'm angry that this continuing revolving door of criminal justice is allowing people to be hurt. And those that say that cashless bail and criminal justice reform hasn't increased crime, I'm not sure where they're looking because it's not true.
What?
And maybe they're looking at the studies on it.
Yeah.
If you're CBS, how about maybe you write about the studies on this. You don't need to take the word of some fucking ex-cop who gives a shit what this guy says.
Also, like, people are lying about bail reform is itself a story that you could that you could just cover.
Fox News published an article headlined, NYPD Officer Jonathan Diller's neighbor, a retired 9/11 responder, says Hochul DAs have, quote, blood on their hands. This entire article is just an interview with the dead cop's neighbor.
But just a random guy, basically.
Where he, quote, blasted Governor Hochul for supporting bail reform policies.
Remember the origin of the lab leak thing where it was literally just some like random guy who was like a military dude and he's like, they have labs in Wuhan.
Right.
Just like a whole story built around this random dude.
This is definitely one of those things where the reporters just go around talking to the neighbors.
Yeah.
And then if they find someone who's like relatively well-spoken and can bust out a few good quotes, that's a whole, that's a whole ass story.
You get to expense your Quiznos.
Right. Yeah. So there's basically no crime that the police and their allies don't see as like an opportunity to push these narratives.
Right.
Even when it doesn't make any fucking sense. And the media is either complicit or incompetent. There is no third way.
Like, it's very obvious the police are making a political argument, but these kinds of stories always get cast as somehow non-political, as if police are just these disinterested actors, like these umpires looking and like, oh, well, it seems this policy is really racist. But like, police have a very clear political valence.
Right.
It's seen as sort of apolitical, even though it's like really, they're really openly pushing for political reforms.
This is a relatively tepid reform. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, every single quote of a NYPD officer should be like, so-and-so looking to justify the NYPD budget says this. Like, so these narratives have sprung up amidst a renewed push by police and conservative media to keep rolling back bail reform. The way this works, by the way, is that the New York budget negotiations happen in the spring. Mm-hmm. So the reform talks tend to pop up in the spring.
Okay.
So in February, the New York Post ran a piece from the editorial board headlined, "The numbers prove it. Bail reform drove a 66% recidivism rate for repeat crooks."
What?
66%? An alarming number. Mm-hmm. At no point in the article did they reference that number again. It's just in the headline.
No way.
The article is about the Data Collaborative for Justice's research, which I touched on earlier. And the whole point that they're trying to make is that the research shows that the progressive reforms haven't worked. Mm-hmm. So let's focus on the headline number, 66%. What they're pulling that from is a number within the research showing that people with a recent prior arrest who were released without bail due to bail reform, 66% of those people were rearrested over the next 2 years, which reads as very high and scary, hence them using it. It's basically the highest number in the whole report. But the obvious question would be, what was the number before bail reform?
Right, because there's no, without context, you have no idea whether that's a big number or a small number.
The answer to that is that the number is 60%. And so that's a 10% increase in this population. That's not nothing, but it is way less scary than the 66% number on its own.
Right.
And it also needs to be weighed against the fact that, for example, there's a 14% decrease in the rearrest rate for people without recent priors. So basically what the Post did was take the scariest number they could find in the report.
Right.
Again, while we're talking about these numbers, it's very easy to lose sight of the fact that bail reform isn't just about reducing recidivism. It's about setting people free who have not yet been found guilty of a crime.
Right. Because you can defend it on like philosophical grounds alone.
Right. You can't just look at the recidivism rates in a vacuum. If recidivism goes from 35 to 40% with bail reform, and I'm just making these numbers up, that's a real policy problem. Mm-hmm. But the other 60% who do not commit crimes and were allowed to be free, that's a real policy win.
Right.
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 Those people would have otherwise been thrown into Rikers.
It's always very difficult to talk about policies in terms of pros and cons.
Right. How do you weigh these things against one another? Right. It's very imperfect.
Right.
My last thought on this is that it's important to understand what the police goal is here. Mm. They complain about bail reform because it doesn't allow judges to decide whether they should impose bail. Mm-hmm. But they'll also complain when judges have the power to impose bail and don't.
Right.
They'll complain when someone gets bail and then actually posts the bail.
Right.
The actual policy preference here is pretty obvious, which is that they want people to be sent to jail pre-trial without any hope of release.
Yeah.
No bail, nothing.
Right.
That's important because for them, scrapping bail reform is step one. And then there's a step two, which is basically eliminating bail altogether,
right.
Not to allow people to be released pretrial, but to force them all to Rikers Island.
Yeah.
A place where conditions are so poor that there's currently a pending case about whether the federal government should seize control of operations.
Oh, man.
It's also important to realize that just as much as the cops have been able to sort of shift public support away from bail reform, most people don't support sending everyone to Rikers either.
Right.
And what cops have been able to take advantage of is the fact that most people just don't understand the system very
well.
And so they can use the press to keep associating progressive policies with all this various anecdotal bullshit.
Right.
And they'll be able to keep doing that until journalists actually start doing their fucking jobs.
Right.
You have to actually write the story about the attempt by the police to manipulate the media.
Right. There should be something of like cops agitate against bail reform amid having 65 PR people who've called us this week. Yeah. There's also funny, there's also a weird sort of like Groundhog Day element to this too, where the policies that the cops are advocating for are just like the same tough on crime policies that we've had, and like we've debated those. And basically all this stuff about like repeat offenders, they're basically trying to bring back three strikes laws.
Right.
Which we all know were super unjust. People were going to jail forever for these like really minor crimes. And so like we've done this. We tried this. It's not like we're trying some new approach. It's like just more of the same.
Right. It's interesting how slowly the public comes to accept and understand that tough on crime policies don't work compared to how rapidly they can be turned around again
using
just a handful of anecdotes, right?
Yeah.
These anecdotes will always be effective because it's always going to be effective for cops to find out that one anecdote where a reform policy led to someone getting killed and be like, do you support that? Do you support that? Mm. Right? That's always going to be very easy for them to do, which sort of, you know, makes me feel a little bit defeatist about this to some degree. But I think what makes me feel less defeatist is the fact that their ability to do that hinges on a multi-billion dollar PR operation that exists in every PD budget across the country, right?
Right.
It's something that would fade from the public consciousness
if
not for this police PR operation.
Constantly inflating it, yeah.
Yeah, I also think like just the slightest bit of good journalism about this would be so helpful.
Yeah, I know.
Just any major papers just sort of huddling up and being like, hey, let's not reprint cop bullshit every single fucking day.
I think it's finally time for like a headline that just says, if there was one word to describe the NYPD, it would be NYPD.
Yeah.